The final case for argument today is Scianciola against Jenkins. Mr. Habermehl.
Good morning. I am pleased to the court. I'm Alan Habermehl. I represent the petitioner and appellant, Mr. Scianciola. The sole issue here is ineffectiveness of counsel. I believe the district court correctly parsed the ineffectiveness portion of the analysis, and I think from the record, to be honest, it's quite clear that the district court was correct in the way it did it. In a sexual assault case where you only have a complaining person and a defendant, and there's literally no other evidence of any kind, no witnesses, no testimony, no physical evidence, nothing. It's that classic he said, she said situation. When the government attempts to tempt those scales, I mean, basically that evidence in equipoise, and it's very difficult normally to try and figure out who's telling the truth or not, because you've got to latch on something to try and break that deadlock. And what the government came up with was an expert who essentially vouched for the victim. And the presentation of the expert was due to the trial lawyer's own blundering in the manner in which he both failed to prepare but then also opened the door to evidence for which he was grossly unprepared to meet. And so, again, it ended up tipping the balance, and all of a sudden the government's got the edge. And in a closely balanced case, even a small edge can be enough. Again, with the evidence in equipoise essentially the way it is, it doesn't take much to tip it one way or the other. The jury's going to be looking for something to grab onto, and the government's expert was convenient in this particular case and provided that something. And as the district court correctly pointed out, the trial counsel apparently did not anticipate that the expert was going to be coming, asked the questions to open the door to the expert's testimony, even though it would be
more. You're arguing this case as if we were making a de novo decision. But under the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, the first question is whether the state court applied settled law unreasonably. In what way was the state court's decision unreasonable?
My reading of the state court decision is that it doesn't even address the question of effectiveness of counsel because to the extent that the state court decision deals with the particular issue we've raised, as far as I can tell, their only discussion of it is a very brief discussion, dealt with the idea that it wasn't prejudicial because the expert being proffered on post-conviction relief wouldn't directly contradict the state's expert. They did not really address the issue. In my understanding, after reading the decision of the Court of Appeals, I don't believe they addressed it directly at all. The district court, I believe, found that they were unreasonable specifically because implicit in the upholding of the conviction would be a finding that counsel was not ineffective. But that would be unreasonable because there are no facts whatsoever to support it. It's objectively unreasonable. Because for the decision to be reasonable, there would have to be facts that meet the standard of law. And the standard of law for a defense lawyer who's countering an expert being proffered by the government on an issue that matters is to do something. Either provide a counter expert, do effective cross-examination. Those are the two things I can think of.
If there is something to be done, but I read the state court's decision as saying, best we can see, there was nothing to be done. Now, you may disagree with that, but if I understand it correctly, the state appellate court said, we reached this decision because the defense has not put its own expert's affidavit in the record. Is that true?
I think that's giving them more credit than they're due to tell
is
you
it
the truth.
Was the affidavit in the state court record?
Apparently not. No, far as I know.
Now, how can it be said that the state court was unreasonable in saying we don't see any contrary expert evidence to be presented when the defense did not put in the record any contrary expert evidence?
The state court didn't just say that the report wasn't in the record. They were able to glean what the expert would have said.
Well, they were trying as best they can to figure out the import of something that had never been put before them. I mean, that's a very hard thing to do. And now you say in federal court that the state court didn't glean that correctly. But we're trying to figure out the reasonableness of what the state court did. And they're not mind readers. They can only go on what's in the record. And it's very difficult for me to see how the state court can be condemned as unreasonable for doing the best they can to interpret something that the defense didn't bother to put in the record.
The state court, again, I think that's giving too much credit. They specifically said that aspects of the opinion of the proffered expert can be, quote, gleaned from it. And they do say, they say the expert apparently opined that there's no identifiable pattern of child behaviors. And they accept that. They don't base their ruling on we don't have a sufficient record. They glean what they can from it and go on to say it's not enough. But I want to point out that
your argument, as I understand it, is they gleaned incorrectly. But like, it's a question whether you think this is a problem of reasonableness under 2254D or of findings of fact under 2254E. Somebody who has an adequate opportunity in the state proceeding to make a factual record and doesn't use it can't come to federal court and say, well, they misunderstood the facts.
Again, I do not read the Court of Appeals decision as saying they misunderstood the facts. I read it as, and I believe reasonableness is a question of constitutional fact, and it is reviewed de novo. The ultimate standard of reasonableness is a legal standard to be applied to whatever behaviors you can find in the record. But it's only half the problem, and I think it's part of the reason that I think it's one of the problems with the state's position in this case. The ineffectiveness wasn't simply failing to provide a counter expert. There is another way to do it, cross-examination. And in fact, that was the strategy identified by trial counsel as his preferred method of dealing with these experts in general and his specific strategy for this case in particular. And the record is undeniable that despite the fact that counsel elected that choice as opposed to proffering an expert, he in fact failed utterly to carry it out. He engaged in no cross-examination whatsoever. The ineffectiveness here is failing to counter the state's expert by whatever method may or may not have been available. And that's the point that I wanted to stress. It isn't just failing to provide an expert of his own. It's failing to counteract the government's expert, the state witness who got on the stand.
So there was no report tendered at any time by the defense, expert report, to the trial court.
There was a report tendered to the trial court for reasons I have no explanation
but
for.
It didn't make it.
It did not find its way to the state court
record.
Of appeals.
Right.
Because there was a post-conviction motion in which the testimony was given regarding that and the report was tendered. That's why the court of appeals was able to glean anything because people referred to it.
Well, I just wanted to get that clear for the record.
Yeah, there is a report. I have no explanation for why it did not get into the record or to the court of appeals. I honestly do not. It strikes me as a failure, but I can't explain it beyond that. But I believe properly viewed, the question of effectiveness is failing to counteract the expert, not limited to simply failing to provide Dr. Esplin. It could have been anyone. It wouldn't have had to be that specific person. What you need to show is that there are available countervailing expert opinions, or else obtain that same information. That is to say, put that same information in front of the jury, that this expert's opinion is not uncontrovertible, that this is questionable, in fact, dubious, by cross-examination, and that can be done. I myself did it not 3 months ago in a trial on almost identical facts in a sexual assault in Milwaukee. And if the question is predicting a change in the outcome, there's a piece of data. It can be done one way or the other. It needed to be done. It's the lawyer's failure to do anything at all, initially to even apparently recognize the problem and then utterly failing to meet it in a case where the single issue was, is this girl telling the truth, is the only issue in the whole case. And as the district court correctly noted, anything that tends to influence that one way or the other is by definition crucial. And to fail to take effective action to counteract the government's tipping of the scales on the only issue that matters is, in my opinion, by definition ineffective and similarly prejudicial. And that's where I part company with the district court. For the district court to say on the one hand what I just said, which I basically paraphrased what the district court said, because it said very well that anything on this issue is crucial, and then to turn around and say, but it doesn't really matter, is logically inconsistent. That strikes me as an unreasonable application of the law to the facts. It must have made a difference. If it hadn't made a difference, there wouldn't be any point in putting it on in the first place. I think it's clear from the record that it makes a difference. And the only explanation I got from the district court's decision is that there was, quote, substantial evidence of many acts of sexual assault presented to the jury. But, in fact, all that happened is evidence that Christina, the one girl, repeatedly told the story to various people. Telling a story to a number of people doesn't make it any more true than if you tell it to one person. What there wasn't was any evidence whatsoever.
She told the story to her friend very close in time to the event, so that counteracts the delayed reporting situation, doesn't it?
It was closer in time. It was to the friend. Part of the problem was the story kept getting better as it got retold, too. But again, telling the story over and over doesn't make it any less of a story. My time's up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Weinstein.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Warren Weinstein. I'm an assistant attorney general with the state of Wisconsin, representing Larry Jenkins, a custodian. The biggest problem, I think, presented in this case is the lack of the expert's testimony. It was, as I understand it, was actual testimony, not just an affidavit that was presented in the post-conviction motion. But neither the report nor the testimony, the transcript, was in the record on appeal. And so the Court of Appeals attempted to determine what that expert testified to based on the arguments of counsel. As Judge Easterbrook pointed out, did the best it could and determined that the testimony presented was not contrary to the state's expert. It seems to me that is a reasonable application on prejudice. The district court apparently disagreed with that, but nonetheless found that the ultimate result was reasonable because the evidence in this case indicated that the defendant had done numerous assaults on Christina over a long period of time, ultimately resulted in charges in three different counties. And this one was in Outagamie and also in Milwaukee and in Calumet. So it's incorrect to say that the only thing in the record was repeated story. In fact, Christina testified to numerous instances of sexual assault. And Judge Williams is correct that the report was entered into evidence in the trial court, but it did not make it into the appellate record. As to the calling of the expert in terms of deficient performance, which the Court of Appeals did not address, the attorney for Mr. Cianciola testified in the post-conviction motion that he didn't want to call an expert because he was concerned that the state would be able to bring out that, as the state's expert testified, delayed reporting was a common occurrence in child sexual assault. Now, whether or not common is the same thing as a pattern, I guess that's where Mr. Hevelmerl seizes on to portray the Court of Appeals decision as unreasonable. But clearly, the expert's testimony in this case was based on her own experience with sexual assault victims. I don't think cross-examination would have done very much on that regard. I mean, what could she say? You're right. I don't know my own cases. I doubt that would happen. So I think cross-examination would probably merely reinforce this expert. And I don't think that it would be easy to find an expert who would say that delayed reporting is uncommon. Certainly, I think the expert, so far as the Court of Appeals determined, his opinion that there's no pattern is probably correct. But it seems to me that it is common, at least the literature that I've seen indicates that it's quite common that child sexual assault victims delay reporting. So it seems to me that the Court of Appeals decision here was objectively reasonable, And it also seems to me that even under a non-deferential review, at least as to calling an expert, there was no deficient performance because it was a strategic choice not to put on an expert who may well have been more damaging than helpful. The Court has no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement, and the Court will be in